Hi, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Hannah Burdett. I'm a professor of Spanish and Latin American studies at California State University, Chico, so nor far northern California.
Thanks for localizing it, Prof. That's handy for people outside the US, even for many people outside California, for that matter. Greatly appreciate and thanks for being here. And I'm very pleased. We've only just met and it's only virtual, but I'm very excited to be talking to a fellow tea drinker. But I'm also very jealous and envious and childish and adolescent in that you're drinking Irish breakfast, which I can't find here. I'm sort of annoyed with you slightly. And I'm especially envious because you've got a fantastic cup, great glazing. But this is not why we are brought together today. We're brought together today to learn something about your research, but also to start off with, to find out what's currently retarding, dynamizing, worrying, interesting you. What's going on?
Yeah, thank you. And I guess I should, I want to also just back up and say, not only do I live in Northern California, I should also mention that I live and work in Matupta territory. I always try to include that territorial acknowledgement, and it slipped past me. But yeah, what am I thinking about and working on? I have the great fortune of being on sabbatical at the moment, so I have lots of time to read and think, which is lovely. I think that we don't really have enough time for that most of the time. It's interesting how my perception of time and everything has shifted when I'm able to like just slow down and read and think. So that's been it's been really nice. It's going by really fast. So I'm working on a project right now on kind of, for lack of a better term, or kind of using some terms as shortcuts, speculative fiction. Indigenous futurisms. I'm looking not only at primarily trying to look at texts by Indigenous authors, engaging in kind of imaginative world building, imagining, drawing on Indigenous stories to imagine other worlds, but also some non-Indigenous authors that are also engaging that work kind of in dialogue with Indigenous literature, Indigenous social movements. And my work is comparative and inter-American in focus, so kind of a little certifiable sometimes because I have this tendency to take on a lot. It's a lot of material. People ask me what I work on. It's all of the Americas. But I'm really drawn by that comparative framework and really thinking about what does it mean to, in these very different contexts to identify as Indigenous, or to, in the context of this current project, to draw on these very different Indigenous knowledges and stories to kind of imagine other possible realities. So yeah, I'm thinking about all that. I'm also trying to think ahead a little bit beyond the sabbatical and prepare for a couple of classes that I'm going to be teaching next year. So in the fall, I'm teaching a course called Indigenous Literature and Translation. And this will be the second time that I've taught that course. And the idea is that we partner with an Indigenous author from Latin America. So last time we did it, we partnered with Negma Coy, who's a Kakchikel poet from Guatemala. And then this time, if everything works out, the plan is to work with Ruperta Bautista, who's a Tzotzil poet from Chiapas in Mexico. So the idea is that my students and I, we read Indigenous literature, think about the issues of translation, and then over the course of the semester, work on translating several of the poems, and then have a public poetry reading with the author. So right now I'm working on trying to actually sponsor the visa for Ruperta to bring her to Chico, which has been a lot, a lot of bureaucratic red tape. So hopefully the plan, is for her to come to Chico in November for that project. And in the spring, I'm going to teach a course called, well, I don't know exactly what I'm calling it yet, but it's the capstone in our Latin American Studies program. And I had the idea to base it on Just Seeds Collective's People Celebrate People's History posters. So they have these a series of posters I forget how many in total. There's a whole book of them, but there's 19 that deal with Latin America and the Caribbean. And so, you know, they're using graphic design and kind of this long history of activism through printmaking to present social movements, history from below, you know, different activists. And so telling stories, so they'll have a text featured and then, you know, an image of some kind. So we're going to research more into the kind of the background of those posters, and then with the idea that then my students will research additional topics and produce their own posters, and hopefully do some kind of a public teach-in or something along those lines. So yeah,
What's the
thinking about a little bit, both of those require a lot of planning and forethought. So
cost of tuition per point? Can I get into the class or both classes? So,
hope my students will be ex as excited about it as I am, but we'll see.
oh, I'm sure they will be. And if they're not, they don't know what they're getting. Now, in terms of issues of translation, which languages are the writers using?
The writers that we're working with in the course or in general?
In the course, yeah.
Well, maybe I'll ask the answer the general question first, and then focus specifically. So in Latin America, this is kind of different from what is the general trend in the US and Canada, and I can't speak as much to other contexts, but in Latin America, the predominant trend among Indigenous authors is to publish bilingually. So they will write in their native language and in Spanish and publish those side by side, or in Portuguese, you know, whatever the dominant languages
Right.
in the country they're working in. And so that in and of itself, I think, is fascinating as a phenomenon that I don't know of any other context worldwide where authors are expected to translate themselves, right? You know, they might write and then someone else translates for them, but like it's like almost expected of Indigenous authors to write in this way. So that is just, I think, fascinating to study and think about for my students.
Yes.
But obviously we don't have the linguistic knowledge and expertise to be able to translate from the native language. So we're working with Spanish, but in constant dialogue with the author. So Negma Coy that we partnered with in 2022, she writes in Cachiquel and in Spanish, and we worked primarily with the Spanish version, but you know, trying to do as much as we could with the Cachiquel. So there's definitely limitations there. But I think as a pedagogical project, I think that there my students and myself, I it was a learning project, you know, process for me too. That they stand to learn a lot for just from that experience of grappling with the nuances of translation, and especially poetry, because, you know, of all the nuances of language, and you know, I think they really start to see the limitations. AI is, I think, a big concern for a lot of people right now. So that they can really see that, you know, when it comes to something like poetry, a human brain is necessary, and I think we really confront the limits of our own knowledge, which I think pedagogically is really powerful for students to think about their own positionality. So we talk a lot about that and kind of ethics and things along those lines.
And what's the sort of ethnic, racial, class background of the student body in general, if it's possible to generalize about that?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think that really shapes what our conversations look like in a lot of ways. So I teach at a Hispanic serving institution. That's an official designation. It means, I think the threshold is 20% of students, the student body, identify as Hispanic or Latinx. I forget what the overall, we're higher than that now. It's about a quarter, maybe about a third of the student body at my university identifies in that way. But then, of course, I teach Spanish and Latin American studies, and so within my division, it's much higher. I'd say around 90% of our Spanish majors identify as Hispanic Latinx. The last time that I taught this course, it was 100% of the students in the class. And so, you know, when we're talking about translation, they talked about how they've had to translate their entire lives for their parents, so the parents could communicate with their teachers in school just as kids, or in the workplace now. So it's like it's a part of the fabric of their daily lives, but they've never quite had to grapple with translating poetry, so that's something new for them.
So they're mostly bilingual. Do any of them
Yes.
have what linguists sometimes call kitchen Spanish? But it's difficult for them when things are more formal and academic and not about familial headquarters, as it were.
Yeah, probably the majority that and then in language teaching, we refer to them as heritage speakers or heritage language learners.
Yes.
So the idea being that they kind of grew up speaking it at home, but they don't necessarily have extensive formal training in the language.
Yeah.
That comes with a lot of baggage in some cases, kind of. And so really part of this translation project is also trying to give students more to empower them, right? To realize the strengths that they have as bilingual people, right? And what they have to contribute, kind of breaking down some of that like internalized, I don't know, barriers, institutional or internalized racism even in some cases where it's assumed to be inferior the way that they speak or and I think really working with Indigenous languages also enables that in a lot of ways because these are also there's also a lot of racism and prejudice against Indigenous languages. In Spanish, they're often just referred to as dialectos, which implies somehow that they're lesser than, they're not really languages. So all of that I think is kind of embedded in the setup of the course.
And in your really, I think, pathbreaking book, Prof. Hannah, Revealing Rebellion in Abya Yala, The Insurgent Poetics of Contemporary Indigenous Literature, one of the things that you do in a very humble way, and I think humility is a great quality, is to talk about learning Indigenous languages, what the process was like, what it required, and so on. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about that and then perhaps expand into the book and all the research that went into it.
Sure, yeah. And I can say one of the kind of challenges for me with this project and kind of the overall focus of my research is because it's comparative and I'm interested in kind of making these connections across contexts, it makes it kind of difficult to pick any one language and really study it in depth, which is kind of has become kind of the standard in my field. A lot of my colleagues working in Indigenous literature focus on one particular region or maybe two really study the language in depth and they have a kind of a depth of linguistic and cultural knowledge that I don't necessarily have because of the focus of my work. But I really think that and so I and I struggle with that sometimes because I think that Indigenous language learning is so crucial. And I've engaged in some of that work, but again, not to the same degree as a lot of my colleagues. I think ultimately both are important in terms of the kind of breadth versus depth. And there's a really important place for that kind of deep knowledge and deep kind of commitment to a particular language, a particular context. But then also there's room for this kind of more expansive comparative work. So I guess just kind of shout out to my colleagues that are really doing that work. So my own focus, well, and I guess I should also just add a little bit more about the importance of the Indigenous language learning. When we think about Indigenous languages, they're totally different in terms of structure. And the way that they articulate understandings of the world, I mean, it's just so totally different. My experience studying Maya Quiche, for example, I also studied a little bit of Aymara in Bolivia, and it's just like the structure is totally different than the way that we even just put thoughts together. And so I think that just the experience of engaging in that that other world and that other way of articulating ideas in the world can be really powerful. I had another thought, but I lost it. Oh, I know. I was just going to say that, and especially when you're dealing with literature and poetry in particular, that there's also the musicality of the language. There's, a whole like embedded meanings and plays on words and a whole different aesthetic tradition. For example, where, rhyming isn't necessarily the primary kind of aesthetic mechanism in poetry. Instead, it might be more repetition or different linguistic structures, poetic structures. So there's a lot there, and I think that all of that Indigenous language learning is a really crucial part of Indigenous literary studies. But to get back to your other part of the question about my book, so the book basically looks at the intersection between Indigenous literature and social movements over the past 30 years or so, and primarily in Latin America, but kind of placing it in dialogue with the US and to a limited extent with Canada. And so I'm interested in basically over the past 30 years or so, there's been this huge surge, boom, increase in both Indigenous literature and social movements in these vastly different contexts, from, say, like isolated pockets of the Amazon and rural reservations to urban centers like Los Angeles or Vancouver or El Alto in Bolivia. And so I'm really interested in what one has to do with the other, poetics and politics. Thinking about what I call insurgent poetics, which is thinking about the role of literature within the broader context of what's often referred to as cultural revitalization. So this kind of broader push for maintaining, recuperating, validating Indigenous knowledges in a broad sense.
And I forget if it's in your book or in an article somewhere, but you write about the supposed gotcha moment when I think it was President Zedillo in Mexico disclosed that Subcomandante Marcos was not of indigenous heritage. And this was meant to discredit the Zapatistas and expose him, all the rest of it. And you write very movingly about that. I wonder if you could reflect on that gotcha supposed moment from Cedillo, and also on your own position in terms of being one of the interlocutors between indigenous Latin American writing and Spanish and also English, which is not meant as a gotcha question at all, but there's an interesting connection here as to who speaks and so on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like so many people, I have been really profoundly impacted by the Zapatistas and a lot of in a lot of different ways. But partly as I'm thinking about my own positionality, my own role as a non-Indigenous ally, what it means to write and think from that position. And I think that's, I mentioned my current project looking at Indigenous and non-Indigenous authors, partly because those are the texts that keep pulling at me, but also because I'm trying to think through my own positionality, my own role. And I think that, oh gosh, the question of Subcomandante Marcos, or, now he goes by Galeano. It's a complex one. I think I personally appreciate the kind of self-reflexivity that he engages in, and kind of very deliberately and in an upfront kind of a way, engaging in a reflection, but then sometimes also in problematic way. It's interesting to see how he uses the word nosotros, for example. Because he's speaking, so again, the idea here is he is the spokesperson for an indigenous movement, but he is himself mestizo. But the fact that he's speaking for this collective, sometimes when he uses nosotros, he's using it in a sense of it implies an indigenous collective because he's just one person among many. He's the minority here, but he's the spokesperson. So there's a really interesting play there on that kind of collective identity. And it certainly is problematic in many ways. But that moment when the president, they revealed it was there was a press conference and they're like superimposing the masked image of Sukuna de Marcos with Rafael Guillen to kind of like they were like it's like they were unmasking him, is just a really interesting, I don't know, and like in semiotic terms, I think it's just fascinating this gesture of unmasking. But I think I don't know how much that ultimately worked. And I think the he continued to play with his own anonymity and I think really discursively interesting ways, suggesting like the ski mask, because he's donning this mask, he becomes part of this collective and he can be, is that famous line, Marcos is, a woman on the streets at night. A Jew in or a Palestinian in Israel, which is really powerful at the current moment, that he can be any oppressed person worldwide. And so I think there's a really interesting play on kind of anonymity and collectivity happening there. The scheme, the Zapatista ski mask is just so rich with meaning in so many different ways, and also kind of connects with my understandings of knowledge and of personhood. And so I think there's a lot there to continue to unpack. The Zapatistas have, so many people have written about the movement and, it's like everybody has something to say, but I still think there's a lot there.
And in terms of some of the traditions that they incarnated or touched on or had projected onto them, one of the other areas you've written on is anarcho-feminismo, sort of anarchist feminism, I guess would be a translation, feminist anarchism. I wonder if you could elaborate a bit on that and its significance.
Sure. So that bit especially connects with my work on the context of Bolivia, and in particular a novel by Alison Spedding. So Spedding is a she's a British anthropologist who's been living in Bolivia for over 30 years, and so she's very embedded in the local context. If you Google an image of her, she you can see she dresses like an Aymara woman, like a chola, and she speaks Aymara. And the part of the description on the back of this novel is that it's the first indigenous novel of indigenous science fiction written in Spanish, Spanglish, and Aymara. So the novel is called De Cuando en Cuando Saturnina, and or Una Historia Oral del Futuro. So Saturnina from Time to Time, an Oral History of the Future. It came out in 2004, I believe. And so which is an interesting moment, because this is like if we think about Bolivian history, 2000 we had the water war in 2000, the gas wars in 2003. So we have this like massive indigenous uprisings that are really shaking the foundations of Bolivia at the time. That then led to Evo Morales being elected as president, I believe 1 year after this novel came out. So it's a really interesting moment. And so she's the basic idea of the novel is it takes place in the 2080s, but it's kind of looking back in time and imagining that in 2022, so now it's in our past, there was a massive indigenous uprising that kicked all the Caras out of the country, so all of the white people. And, then there's this like massive, change in society. There's no longer a state, a state government in the sense that we would recognize today, but instead it's structured on the basis of the Ayllu, this kind of Andean Quechua Aymara system of governance. And so the active or the protagonist of the novel is a lesbian anarcho-feminist hacktivist named Saturnina Mamani. And so she like challenges a lot of the patriarchal structures of this society. She engages in acts of terrorism, like for instance, bombing the Ku Klux Klan territory on Phobos, moon orbiting Mars, I think it is. So it's kind of a crazy novel, but she's drawing a lot on the ideas of this anarcho-feminist collective, Mujeres Creando Comunidad, and the kind of basically making this criticism of patriarchy that goes beyond just the structures of colonialism. Settler colonialism, or you know, the what Maria Lugones refers to as the coloniality of gender, kind of thinking about all right, let's imagine that this massive uprising takes place and we restructure society. There's no longer a neoliberal state. You know, then what? And her answer is, well, we still have this problem of gender inequity, and kind of thinking about the some of the gender issues that are present in Aymara society as a kind of critique. So yeah, that's some of the work that I've done on that. I'm still kind of thinking and working through some of those issues, some of those concerns and other texts that deal with those ideas. Julieta Paredes is one of the main people involved with one of the founders of Mujeres Creando. They eventually had a split, kind of a personal and ideological split. And so then they formed Comunidad Mujeres Creando Comunidad. So, yeah.
And in terms of Dr. Spedding, Professor Spedding, what's your take? Because at one level, anthropologists are often criticized for finding themselves in the other, whether they do tourism for 6 months or 12 months as part of their PhDs, or they're actually making the commitment to move somewhere else for the rest of their lives. And the issue of dressing in local indigenous form. Are there issues there for you at all?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't, you know, I don't want to. I haven't met Spedding personally. I wasn't able to coincide with her when I was doing my field work in Bolivia during my PhD program. But so I, you know, I don't want to speculate on that particular case. I can speak for myself. When I was in Guatemala, I spent a summer in Nahuala studying Maya Quiche and staying with a Mayan family. And for our concluding ceremony, that was traditional for everyone that was, you know, or graduating from this program, to wear the traje, and so huipil and the skirt, and it winds around, and you use a faja to tie it. And so they asked me a couple weeks before, oh, what's your favorite color? To know the context, and so then they gifted me with this outfit, which is beautiful. And I don't know what to do with it
I was going
because
to say,
I don't have
you're
any context. I mean,
not.
if I spent more time in Guatemala, you know, in the communities, then maybe there would be more of a context for it. But outside of that context, I don't know any, you know, I don't know of any context where it doesn't, where it would feel appropriate for me to wear it. But I do have one of my good friends and colleagues, Tiffany Miller, shout out, does a lot of work in Guatemala, and you know, she wears the traje típico a lot, and she said that for a lot of the communities there, what they have expressed to her is that it's a sense of pride to see a gringa speaking their language, wearing the traditional clothing. But I know it's also a constant balancing act, and kind of, and her book, which is brilliant, by the way, The Maya Art of Speaking Writing. One of the things that I really admired about her book is the this kind of self-reflexivity that she engages in, and constantly thinking about her own positionality and what it means to be, you know, a settler ally in this context, in this field, non-Indigenous, working on, you know, Mayan studies. So I think it's a constant balancing act, and I think for me I don't know, it's something that I keep coming back to and feeling uncomfortable about, and I think it's supposed to be uncomfortable. I don't think you're supposed to get to a point where it's just like there's an easy answer and you know it's done. It's something that at least for me, that I have to continue to think about and be aware of, kind of thinking about my own role.
It's interesting, isn't it, the cultural politics of this stuff, where you're encouraged in this by the local community. Without your knowledge, they are giving you a major sign of having graduated into their community. But if you wore this to a party in the United States, people would probably not like it very much and wonder what you were doing and would talk about cultural appropriation. And these contexts really do give entirely different valencies, significations, politics to what apparently is the same object that has been created for the same person, right? The meaning is just utterly different. So I appreciate that. And it's just too bad that you love it so much, but you don't feel able to wear it. But I get why. I absolutely understand. I think it's a great point and a complex one. And as you say, I raise the question of the prof not to attack her, but just because it seems to me she's incarnating, embodying, experiencing some of these contradictions and paradoxes. And occasionally it's all too easy for people to attack anthropology when much of it is not just dedicated to imperial and colonial fantasies. It's actually dedicated in a kind of Boasian way to the different values and norms of different cultures and the importance of understanding them in a non-teleological way. So I take the point. In terms of being in a Spanish department, that's part of what you do. Is there a place there for students to learn other Latin American languages other than Spanish and perhaps Portuguese, to learn the non-colonial languages that we've been referring to?
Not in my institution, I wish. And in fact, when I started, I think we're in a time where language instruction as a whole is declining in very concerning ways. So I've been at Chico State for 8.5 years, and when I started, we had 10 languages in my department. Now we barely have five. And Spanish is hanging on for obvious reasons, state of California, Hispanic serving institution. But language instruction in general is struggling, and it's not just Chico State, it's a nationwide problem. And I think, now with AI being what it is and growing as it is, it'll be interesting to see where things go from here. But that said, I do know that there are other institutions that are engaging in that work. I have friends and colleagues who teach classes in Nahuatl, for example. My friend Adam Kuhn at University of Minnesota Morris. I think he's teaching a Nahuatl course in the fall. And so that work is happening elsewhere. I wish that we had more of that at Chico State. Some classes in Maidu, for example, would be really cool, but there's also a fairly limited number of speakers in the area, which all the more reason to have classes in the language, I think. But
Of
and I
course.
think some of that is happening in the community. I've heard some comments here and there about some limited Maidu classes at the at the tribal offices, Matuta tribal offices. But yeah, I'd love to see it happen, but it's not,
And it can be an
unfortunately,
issue in
reality.
Latin America too, thinking of African descended folks. You know, Palenque is not really taught in Colombian high schools or colleges. I mean, it's a matter of grandparents sometimes sitting down with grandchildren and teaching them Palenque when their own children maybe never learned it.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the other thing that I would say is, even in places like Oaxaca in or Chiapas in Mexico, where there's a huge indigenous population, and a lot of speakers in the languages, they're still often not being taught. And it's again, it's a lot of kind of prejudice and internalized racism and assumptions about the languages and lack of funding and a whole host of factors. And bilingual education is growing. I think it's better now than it was 30 years ago. But it's still, I think, a constant struggle because the European colonial languages are so dominant. And because there's a lot of, I don't know, again, just kind of assumptions about inferiority of the languages, which are obviously misplaced. And a lot of times languages aren't necessarily being passed on. In that context, I think I've done a little bit of work on indigenous language hip hop, and I think it's really fascinating because it's a context where we wouldn't necessarily associate hip hop with indigenous music or indigenous languages, but it's there's a kind of cool factor for the youth, but then also it's a way of maintaining and passing on the language, and so there's a kind of interesting intergenerational relationship there, where sometimes elders in the communities say they really like it because the language is being passed on, and it gives a new sense of pride in the language. I don't know what it says that we have to associate it with this kind of like global cultural context for that to enable that sense of pride, but I think it's a really fascinating example of language revitalization, because of the ways in which it also kind of pushes back on our expectations of, what indigenous cultural production is supposed to look like, and
Yes,
this
indeed.
expectations that we have that it's just kind of like timeless and
Yes,
unchanging.
right. Beautifully put. And of course, this also makes me think about questions to do with the idea of almost freezing Indigenous peoples in time, as you suggest. But also, in the first 2 years of COVID-19, I was living in Mexico, and all the public health messages were only in Spanish. So one of the problems for Indigenous communities was not understanding these messages about washing your hands, about wearing a mask, so on. Yeah? A big issue. And another issue was that I guess roughly 20, 25% of the Mexican population is analphabetic, and a fair proportion of that percentage are Indigenous peoples. So these ideas about how you can protect people were excluding those folks, sometimes doubly, quite apart from the other forms of social exclusion suffered. It's one of the incredible ironies of a place like Mexico that, as you know, if you go into the town square, there will be probably a social realist image of an indigenous looking peasant, campesino figure in the Zócalo on the plinth. To mark the town, even though that person in his subjectivity may be very unwelcome in many sections of the town or the city. And it's rather like, in some ways, Aboriginal Australians, where people can, in synecdochic ways, actually stand for the entire country while being incredibly marginalized by it. You know? A bit like the figure of woman as nation. I was at the Prado on Sunday, and just seeing the number of 19th and 18th century works of European masters, all males in these cases, where the light is always on the female body, who may be the only woman in a martial scene, and probably, if not topless, then her utter chest, upper chest and neck exposed, and all the light being on her whiteness, as she is the nation to be fought for by all these grubby guys, with spears in their stomachs and whatnot, roaming around beneath her, where this sort of pictorial investment in a type of person is entirely unmatched by the person's actual power in the place being described and commemorated. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I was just talking about hip hop. That reminds me a lot of Mapuche hip hop artist Luanco in Chile has a song that basically says "Sáquenos de la moneda." So the one of the coins in Chile has an image of a Mapuche person, And so the song is a critique of that and saying that, you know, the Chilean nation is kind of appropriating the image of the Mapuche for this national identity kind of project, nation building project. And yet then they're also out there, you know, denying Mapuche rights and persecuting, you know, there's still a big issue with Mapuche political prisoners. There was a law instituted during the Pinochet dictatorship that at the time was used to disappear and to torture people that were suspected of being dissidents, you know, opponents of the dictatorship. And now that same law is being used to persecute Mapuche activists. And so, you know, there's this like there's a disconnect, right, between this kind of happy image of the nuestros indios, you know, that phrase that's often used, kind of reclaiming that, you know, indigeneity for building a national identity, while at the same time denying the current presence of indigenous people in the country. I mean, I think a context like Mexico, where it's like indigeneity is an ingredient of mestizaje. Right. It's, you know, it's one of the things that we then use to build this national identity. But it's assumed to be this thing of the past and not, you know, entire communities that are a constituent part of the nation today, that are still being excluded. So there's a lot, and that looks differently. And, you know, it looks different in different contexts, you know, in Mexico, where mestizaje is really, you know, fundamental, proud part of the national identity. It looks different than in Chile, where the Mapuche were never conquered by Spain. They were conquered by Chile, by the Chilean state. And so there's a different, even more antagonistic relationship there.
I don't know if you've ever seen Nuevo Orden. Do you know that film?
No, I don't.
It's a French-Mexican co-production. It's about indigenous workers in a Weizsäcan oligarchic home preparing the food for the wedding of the Weizsäcan daughter of the family, who take out guns and knives and kill everybody they can see. And this is part of a green paint daubing that goes on across Mexico City that is the sign to rise up. It's an astonishing film. But it is trying to get away from that image of nuestros indios and the idea that you get in a film like Roma, which is they're really members of the family. But the systematic exclusion leads to this revolutionary violence in Nuevo Orden. It is very disturbing, but remarkable. Really fascinating. Anyway, sorry, I'm not trying to trump you by throwing in a reference to something. It just made me think about that in terms of the building up of resentment. The other thing I wanted to ask you about is in the Chilean context. This reminds me a little bit of what happened in Colombia. Chile and Colombia, for folks who don't know this, both had big plebiscites in the last few years. The one in Colombia over ratifying peace with the FARC guerrilla, and in Chile to create a new constitution, a post-Pinochet constitution that would include rights for indigenous peoples in a very significant way, I think, right? Both these plebiscites were lost. The Colombian one very narrowly, and with all kinds of contingent explanations for why. The Chilean one very significantly lost. One thing both yes campaigns had in common was a vast literature that was produced about what the vote would involve. Yeah. And I wonder about the efficacy of making arguments like that, because in the same year as the Colombian plebiscite, there was the referendum in Britain about Brexit, where the material said, "Do you think Britain should leave the European Union?" Question mark. Nada más. You know, very effective, big turnout, nothing much to read, just express an opinion, and off you go. Whereas the incredible verbiage of the Colombian and Chilean instances seems to have alienated some people. Or would you attribute that in the Chilean case more to things like anti-Mapuche and anti-feminist sentiment?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I know it, so I have a good friend who is actually from Chico originally, but has been living in Chile for a long time, and now she's here this semester doing her sabbatical,
Oh,
Allison Rainey.
lovely.
Yeah, and so we've been talking some about this, and she's good friends with Elisa Loncón, who is a Mapuche woman who and I forget exactly what her role was. She's no longer in that role because it I think because it was very contentious, and I don't want to misspeak. But it seems like there's definitely something there, in terms of both gender politics and there's a lot of kind of discourse about including Mapuche voices in the process, but I think also still a lot of embedded internalized racism or internal racism within the country.
I wanted to ask you one more question, if I might, Prof, and then invite you to add anything you wish to conclude our conversation. Does that sound all right as a way of finishing things? So, my question is really one to help the audience out if they're not familiar with these things. Could you help us to understand the difference between the way indigeneity is generally understood in Latin America versus how it's understood in the white settler colonies, like Canada, the United States, Aotearoa, New Zealand, Australia? Because it is quite distinct, I think, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. That's a big question, something that I'm thinking a lot about. And it's so complicated that it's I have to kind of simplify a little bit in order to break it down. But sometimes simplifying is or making generalizations can be helpful. So in the US context, just with a an asterisk there, that we're
Don't
glossing
hate
over
me. Don't
a
hate me.
lot, right? But in the United States and Canada, where we have federal recognition of tribes that are considered domestic dependent nations that have recognized sovereignty that has been constantly attacked and undermined, but that nonetheless exists in that form, is also very complicated in the history. It basically has colonial origins. Blood quantum, for example, which is this idea that you can measure how indigenous a person is based on their ancestry and what percentage of their ancestry is full-blooded indigenous. But of course, that's based on these Dawes rolls, for example, and so the context of the so-called five civilized tribes. That these were registers that were taken in a colonial context. So that the white people in power and the government could track who was indigenous, and ultimately with the goal of diminishing the amount of people that would be considered indigenous, so that white people could take their land, which is the inverse of the one drop rule in the United States, which was this idea: if you have a single drop of African blood, then you're black. So we want to increase the amount of people that would be considered black, so that we can enslave more people, and we want to decrease the amount of people that would be considered indigenous so that we can take their land. So that's kind of, and yet, then that blood quantum is not the sole criteria. It's the one that gets a lot of publicity. It's one of the criteria that is used to determine citizenship in different tribes. If you try to apply that context, that concept to Latin America, it just completely falls apart. Right? Like if you try, okay, blood quantum, first of all, there's no roles like that. There's no like lists of who was full-blooded indigenous and who pertained to what tribe. That doesn't exist. But also, even just if we apply that standard of percentage to a country like Mexico, it just falls apart. Maybe everybody would be, not everybody, but a huge percentage of the population would be indigenous. And so then in Latin America, and again, we're talking about 20 something different countries, and so, generalizing, but generally in Latin America, it's understood less in these kind of formalized terms of citizenship in a particular nation than it is. It's defined more culturally. So do you speak the language? Are you part of a community, which is always a central question in all of these different contexts? Do you wear the traje típico? Do you dress wearing the traditional attire of the community? And so, all of that also comes with colonial baggage in some ways, in terms of, like we were talking about earlier, expectations that you're not allowed to change. If you wear blue jeans, oh, you're not indigenous. If you don't speak the language anymore, no longer. And so, in these different contexts, we see the ways in which indigeneity is understood and defined in, often in and important and powerful and in empowering ways, but also, what I find fascinating is when you put these two things together, these different understandings of indigeneity, how the place in between, it just starts to fall apart. And I think that place where the two things come together is just fascinating. I think can really reveal a lot of assumptions that we have and kind of ingrained colonial mentalities and expectations of what it means to be indigenous that I think ultimately can, I don't know, I think on the one hand, it can be helpful to expand the understanding of what it means to be indigenous, but also, we have to be careful with that. In the US, there's a whole discourse around, so-called pretendians, this idea of people that are claiming indigenous identity and ancestry that they don't have, right? And often to take advantage of available resources, it's often academic, so that gives them an extra level of credibility or cultural cachet. So as with many things, I think it's a balancing act, but
Complex one. I live very close to the Mexican Cultural Center here in Madrid, and it has fantastic events all the time, as you can imagine. And one of the big things that draws in huge crowds is El Día de los Muertos, and not just on the day itself, but in the weeks surrounding it. I went there with some Spanish friends who were really interested in the traditions of this, that, and the other, right? In terms of what animals might mean, women's clothing, all kinds of things. You know what I mean? At the shrines to people. And I said, this is fantastic and it's all true and it's all real. But if you're in Mexico, they're going to have packets of Marlboro and Coca-Cola cans along with the Virgen de Guadalupe in these memorials to people in the popular classes. But there's no way that the official culture of Mexico is going to make this part of the Day of the Dead. It's just not kosher, right? And I mean, it's inspiring, but it's only part of a story. And it is about this t official tendency that really lots of these societies have to freeze indigeneity in an approved mode. Yeah. But discussing. So anyway, Prof, I wonder if we could conclude with your adding anything that we haven't touched on that I missed, or something that we did touch on where there are other things you'd like to say.
I don't know that I can think of anything. It's been a lovely
Great.
conversation.
Well, thank you. I would normally these podcasts get interrupted by the podcat who runs around and sometimes attacks me and scratches me. I have to say he's been asleep the whole time, but I saw a very beautiful podcat on your lap, I think, at different times. Before we end things, can you tell us about your podcat?
That's the first I've heard that word, podcat. That's great. Yeah, I have two, although one is always wants to be, on my lap or on the chair right behind me here.
Yes,
But
that I saw.
I have two that are now considered elderly cats, Sophie and Bella. So
Adorable. Well, it was lovely. I don't know whether I saw both or one, but it was adorable. So thank you so much, Prof. Hannah. I really admire your work and I learned even more, I think, talking to you today. As you can tell, I come at these things from a position of ignorance. And so I really gained a great deal from our chat, and thank you very deeply for it.
This has been, this is fun. Thank you.